I am Jeanette Manning. I am an alcoholic. Hear me okay? Sober today only because of God AA and sponsorship since August 28th of 1988, and for that I owe you my life. I am the newcomer next to these two gentlemen here. Grateful Lester's here because he's younger than me. I just need to know if there's anyone under a year of sobriety here in the room today. Right on. Woo! Right on. I promise you that as I was being placed in protective custody Mother's Day weekend of 1988, that I was not envisioning this day with you. Okay? I always say I'm living a dream I never knew I had. I am so grateful to Eva for asking me to participate, most importantly to my friend Carol, who gave her my name, and a line of sponsorship that has taught me to always say yes. But most importantly, to my mother, who I give great gratitude and thanks for the blood that runs through my veins. I am Blackfeet Indian. I am from the great state of Montana, although I'm doing time in Texas, so if there's any Savage Plains Indians out there with me, we could really have a massacre on this town. I was born on the San Carlos Indian Reservation in southeastern Arizona, which is where my mother, my mom, having kissed a cute Marine in Southern California, I happened, and once she found out that he was married, she took off to be with her father and her mother, and my grandparents took her in, and my grandpa was working in San Carlos at the time. And my father, finding out that my mom was pregnant with me, tracked her down and left that first family and a son that was born. I have a brother born in April of 71, and I was born in October of 71. So my dad was very busy. And so my dad tracked my mom down and thus would spend, you know, the next very many years of my life with shattering glass and in and out of foster homes. And every time something broke in the middle of the night and every time he punched her and every time she ended up in ICU, it was my fault. Because if she'd had never gotten pregnant with me, he had never hunted her down. And I understand this disease today, and I understand that my father had it. But most importantly, I understand that I had nothing to do with me, you know, because I felt like my mother's people looked at me with that contempt and that disregard. You know, because I was Gunny's daughter and carried that for a really long time. Now, I'm a mudblood. I thank Harry Potter for teaching me that term. I'm a half-breed. So on my reservation, I was dirty and not a part of and didn't belong. But then I come to your city and I am spit on and I got gum thrown in my hair because I did not fit in and belong. So where do you fit and what do you do? You know, my whole life, it is the color of my skin. But most importantly, just being the dirty little Indian girl from the wrong side of the tracks. You know, I spent some time in Butte, Montana as a kid and used to shine shoes at the M&M and the shanty and the shack. And all my uncles were in there. You know, my mom is one of 14 and my dad is the oldest of 17. So, yes, we're Catholic. And and so, you know, I spend my life following my dad all around these bars, you know, and shining shoes and never wanted to drink. Didn't want to be like my uncles. You know, I had Uncle Bill who married a Hopi woman and he would, you know, he would carve Kachina dolls on my couch and he would say, Coyote, don't drink that hooch. It'll make you crazy. And but I had no idea. I don't have a coming to know you story with alcohol. I don't have this fabulous first drink story. You know, I just feel like I've always drank. You know, I had a sponsor who talked about, you know, she drank two bottles of wine with six girls, which we know right there is bad math, at a church camp, and they ran around the camp to have the alcohol go through their system. I don't have that. I can just tell you that my whole life, and you can call my mother right now, she will tell you that I am the girl your mother warned you about. My mom was warning you about me. I always got a plan. I always got something going on. And I'm raised in the most beautiful place, the place of the last stronghold you could force my people, Glacier Park. And I get this idea one day, you know, because I'm always the kid who got to go to town to get the commodities, right? Because something's going to happen. Something's going to happen. You leave me home unattended, it is on. And I'd get to go to town, and we'd come back, and I got this idea that I'm going to catch a bear. And so I take, you know, the federal government's idea of nutrition for us is, you know, a number 10 can of heavy peaches and syrup and, you know, fruit cocktail, powdered eggs, glowing blocks of orange cheese. You know what I'm talking about. And I open up those cans, and I'm very detail-oriented. If you look in my purse, you know, things are in zipper pouches. My kitchen's labeled. I am squared away because it's good for me. I do really well in that coat that ties in the back. And I make these rock piles with all this fruit, and I'm sitting on the well, and I'm waiting for a bear, and I'm waiting for a bear. My grandmother lives on in the eastern front of the Rocky Mountains. I mean, I am raised in absolutely glory, and I'm waiting for a bear, and I'm waiting for a bear. And I can remember the story later being told, what is she doing out there? And my grandma said, nobody's bleeding, nothing's on fire, leave her alone. And so I just sat there, and now unbeknownst to me, there's a truck ripping through the drive. My Uncle Huey comes flying out the back porch with his braids on fire, and he's got a .30-06. My grandmother's screaming in Blackfeet, and there's a silver-tipped grizzly lumbering down the ridge. And I go running, it's my brother Bear. You know, I'm tracing this bear, and, you know, the ranger comes down because that's who's coming in, and I get scolded. I will take the consequence. I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to be punched. I'm going to get grounded. I don't care because it's going to be worth it. Buckle up. And so I get a talk from the ranger about why we don't feed the bears, and I get a Smokey the Bear poster, you know, and I got beat to high heaven. But that was the summer of the black bear and the cinnamon bear and the brown bear. I mean, it was a busy summer for me because I tell you what, I got it going on. And so, you know, that I needed a drink, man, really bad. The first relief I ever got was cutting on myself and burning myself. And it happened by accident, right? Because I love fire and fire water. And so I'm burning straws in my attic one time, and accidentally this plastic dripped onto my skin. And I was like, oh. So I have dime-sized scars all over my legs, man, just to get it off of me. Man, everything that is wrong with me, that I'm not enough, I'm not native enough, I'm not pretty enough, my boobs are not big enough, my hair is not on and on, I'm not tall enough. Everything that can be wrong with me, back up, leave me alone. And then again, you took my land. So I'm a little pissed. I'm a lot pissed, actually. And I will not tell you about my experience at Turner Field this week. I did not go to jail. Y'all need to know I did not go to jail. Thank you, Jesus. So God, I need a drink. And I tell you what, you might have initials after your name. You may be a doctor. I don't care. We own a bar. My family owns Kipp's Beer Garden right outside St. Mary's. And so when you were 10 years old and you were washing cups behind the bar, there's no greater place to be. It was the best time of my life, and I am a smart chick. I am not, like, I have friends who would, like, pour it into mustard and ketchup bottles to smuggle it out. I'm taking the whole bottle, and I'm taking a fifth, and I like Everclear. I am drinking Jack Daniel's, Jim Beam, and Johnny Walker Red. I'm getting drunk. I don't know about you. If you're decorating your drinks, if you have an umbrella in it, if you had a wine spritzer, I apologize now, because I'm drinking. I don't know what you're doing, but I'm drinking. I'm guzzling whiskey, and I am the drunken babysitter. I'm the babysitter you paid in a quarter bag in a case. I would come over to your house, and I would clean your house and wash all them sour milk bottles your baby's been eating on all week. And I would vacuum up that carpet with that smoking Hoover vacuum. I smell a burning vacuum belt today, and I'm like, oh, it's like nostalgia, man. You come home at bar 30 with him, and it is on, right? Because I've got $13.50, and that's a fifth. And I've got the keys to your car because we got to go. I learned how to drive drunk in a stolen car. So I promise you, I know the right shade of green. I know where to go and how to go and when to go. And I'm a fighting drunk. I'm not a crying drunk. I'm not the girl that you're going to buy a Valentine. I'm not interested in a mezpah. If you were going to prom with him, I'm sorry. It was just convenient. He was there. You know, I'd come to out of blackout and be like, whoa, don't even tell me your name. It's a little late now. Shoot. I gotta go. Not interested. I am not. I promise you, I don't buy me a mezpah. Okay, not happening. But what did happen, fortunately for me, is that my whole life I believed that I can shapeshift. And my mom, if I'm serious, call Marcy right now. She will tell you that when I'm a tiny baby and she's looking for me and she can't find me, you know, she'd walk into a room, poof, I'd be there. And then she'd go out of her room and she'd look for me. There I was again. And I never got busted. I don't have a DUI. I don't have a minor in possession of alcohol. I've got various assault charges. But I've never been busted, because I promise you, man, this one time I'm drinking in Helena, Montana, and the cops are coming. You know, it's that place where the guy fresh out of the joint lives with his girlfriend and their baby, right? You know, and we're drinking there, and I've got these two beers, and I'm watching this baby in its crib, and this baby's got snot on its face, and it's crying, and I'm like, man, this is wrong. But we just couldn't stop. And then, you know, there was a cellar. I come from the place where we get to have basements. I think it's very necessary if you drink like me. Because you got to have a place to hide. And so this, you know, this time the cops would come, we'd be like, 5-0. And, you know, some lineman or fullback would hold that cellar door and we'd shoot down the cellar stairs. And it was a good time to hook up with someone if you hadn't done so yet. And I made it to the cellar door too late. And I am too light to fight. I'm like maybe 80 pounds with a brick in my pants. And I'm like, oh my God, lights and red and blue and cops. And I'm not going to get caught. I am not going to stand in front of my mom because I'm going to get grounded. One, you know, hour for every day that I'm late. So, you know, it's going to be like 35 days later and I'm not going to get to come home. So I whipped myself up underneath this ledge and there's a, thank you, Idaho, for being our neighboring state. And I took this bag of potatoes and I stuck them all over me. Think your potato. Think your potato. Man, that cop came in there. There was no one in there but us potatoes. And I tell you what, I have been trees. I have been all manner of everything because I'm not going to get caught. And what I just started to do is I just started to die a little at a time. You know, it's that place we get to that it wasn't some big colossal thing. I don't have a DUI. Yes, I put your daughter in the hospital. I don't have, you know, any crazy story of anything but the end, like just over and over and over and over and yet again an end. And I will figure out anything to get you off my back. It is the color of my skin. It is that I'm a girl because that's my first resentment. In my tribe, the boys get to fancy dance without their shirts, and I think that's discrimination, you know? So gratefully, I started, as people started coming, I started getting put in chemical awareness classes because I was very chemically aware, and I got a lot of things going on at that time. And so I get to, I get placed in these classes and they're talking to me about, you know, my people and they're talking to me about, you know, how dangerous this is and on and on and on. I'm like, get over it, whatever. I don't even care. You know, because in 1985, I started shouting at the devil and I shaved my head and had a mohawk and had black eyeliner on and a Metallica metal up your ass shirt on. I was back up. And my poor mom, you know, man, when you're cooking eggs at 8 o'clock in the morning and that shows up for breakfast, whoa, you know, my mom would be like, baby girl, what's the matter? I'm like, I'm evil. God, I didn't ask to be born. And poor Marcy, you know, and here's my mom, powwow drums and sweetgrass smoke billowing out of my house. I'm like, oh, will you make it stop? Right? You know, we're going to Indian days and we're going to my grandma's. I'm like, you know, and I got to tell you, I'm a big fan of teepee creeping and I am a big fan of stick games and I'm a big fan of the heritage and the pride and the absolute. I texted my mother this morning and I said, Mom, thank you so much. How proud I am, because I tell you what, when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was a Japanese-German woman that carried the message of recovery to me. And she was old, man. She was like over 40. And I came to that meeting. I came to that meeting and that woman was knitting with a hula hoop, right? And I came to that meeting, there's smoke billowing everywhere and there was a guy with bifocals on. There's some guy who didn't have, yeah, he was pushing his teeth in and out of his mouth. I was quite intrigued by that. And there's another woman who didn't have her kids and boo-hoo, the state had taken her kids. And then they said, do you want what we have? Oh my God, no. Thank you very much. I do not. But it's a generous offer. Gotta go. And I sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for months because I'm here for alcohol only. And they would say to me, Jeanette, we believe that we use the Southern California definition of clean and sober. We believe that you should be, you know, we refrain from anything that affects your family. I'm like, this is native. This is my pipe. They'd be like, stop smoking pot. Okay, and I'd sit in the meetings and I'd punch myself and I'd be like, God, I hated all of you. If you owned land, if you had a checkbook, if you had a credit card when you got sober, you're pathetic. Okay, because what kind of an alcoholic gets sober with a credit card? Seriously. The state of Montana would not let me drive. I was 16 years old when I got sober and I came to you people, just a menace. And what has happened, folks, is a wholesale miracle has taken place. I am a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat in that room and I sat with that woman and she took me through that book a page at a time. And she explained to me the grave nature of alcoholism. She explained to me that it went far beyond the color of my skin. And that someday I would be uniquely useful to my people, but that it had nothing to do to separate me. Because my whole life I am different, and every single one of us different, worse. And now we can do all kinds of things to change ourselves. There's more options than I really need to have. So I just tell you that knowing what is wrong with me today and knowing what I have to do to make me right is the most important thing I have to tell you. That I am sober since August the 28th of 1988. That I have a solution that I absolutely champion. I am militant, people. There's a couple of women that I don't sponsor, but I sponsor their sponsors who stayed in the room. And so I will tell you, and with my grace, I'm delighted they're here. I will tell you that everybody in every direction of my life is intact. everybody. The kids are all right, right? We are sober. We are productive. We are useful. We are here with all of you enjoying a life that we do not deserve, but I fight for every day. I promise you that I have been saved from a fate worse than death. I kissed a cute boy in Alcoholics Anonymous against sponsor direction. I do not recommend that. I think that you should make your amends and use birth control. But that is another meeting and another time. Because what happened on July the 21st when that very cute boy and I had our first date? April the 22nd, we had our first baby. And true story, boop, 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 9 months to the day. And he had a sponsor. He had a home group. He had a commitment. He was a coffee maker. They wouldn't let me make the coffee because I would talk about dropping acid in the coffee pot, man. Bottom of the hour, woo, watching you guys spark. You people need to chill. Well, he was a coffee maker. And I assure you that I did not realize he did not have a sobriety date. Oops. So when my sponsor was done wanting to beat the crap out of me, and we had made a baby, you know, we made a commitment. It was like, where are we going to go and what are we going to do? And I promise you that the last 23 years of this poor kid's life, you know, the disaster has been because he made a commitment and he followed through and he followed up. And what we have built is an absolute legacy of love. We popped out a couple more kids and, you know, because I'm a big fan of that. And, he was drunk and I was sober and Alcoholics Anonymous and I powerhouse. I did everything you people told me to do, where you told me to do it, when you told me to do it. I have nothing else but the result and the evidence of this solution in my life. That I'm sitting in a meeting when I'm 11 years sober and it's a panel on, Native American, and I'm sitting in the meeting going, I wonder if you have to be Native to share in this meeting. And then I go, stupid you are. And I'm like, oh, that's right. Because again, I was different. I was wrong. I was dirty. And it is my one of my most powerful attributes. Because I am the exception. I am not the rule. I am the exception. The fact that I am long time sober and that I stand in front of you fully clothed is amazing. Amazing. And being able to have this, you know, to have this experience and to build a marriage and everything in my life that never happened. I'm the only one of my mom's kids who graduated high school. I'm the only one who graduated college. I'm the only one who went on to graduate school. And not through any fault of their own, because they are amazing, incredible people. I love my siblings so much. I asked my grandma one time, why did she have so many kids? And she said, because someday when I left this earth, they were only going to have each other. And I am so grateful for my brothers and my sister and the legacy of getting to love them and cherish them, you know, where we are in our lives. And we've just had a hullabaloo, man. But the most important thing I'm going to tell you in the last couple minutes is that, you know, I came to you people without an idea of what was wrong with me and convinced that it was your fault. And I stand here today with such a solution. The 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous, as it was originally written. And I absolutely love, you know, our co-founders in their just brilliance that we carry this message to others, especially alcoholics. It wasn't just to alcoholics. I believe in the singleness of purpose, but I carry this message to others. There are people in my life today who need to see the solution that are outside the rooms. There are people in this life that I need to be a calling card. I need to be the evidence that you can live this way. It's not just for us. You know, it was one of the greatest thing that I have to tell you is, oh my God, if you do not believe in a God bigger than you and you can deny his evidence everywhere, you cannot deny his existence in my life. Because I know today my charge that if I fail to bring you that peace and that presence just by being with you, then I have not done my job. And that is something that I absolutely cherish. You know, Jason and I popped out a couple more kids and we've raised our kids in Alcoholics Anonymous. And a few years ago, you know, we always pray with our kids because I don't know what to do with them, right? So what I did, I'm like, you got to brush your teeth and you got to give them vitamins. And man, you got to take into the, there's a lot of work. I don't know if you know this because man, when they gave us the baby to take home, I was like, and when you take the baby home, I'm like, we're not taking the baby home. Are you crazy? It's on video. I'm like, you people are crazy if you're going to send that baby home with me. So the good news is that a good sponsorship and a great home group will teach you how to make baby food. And so we started going to churches to find a way of life and to find a faith for our kids, and we ended up at the Church of Our Father. And, you know, for a long time I had a screaming resentment at the Catholic Church, and what ended up happening is we went all in, you know, just like we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We sit in the front row and we be on time, and, you know, my kid came home from youth group one night and he said, Mom, I need you to pray for my wife. And I was like, okay, what's your name? We have acquired a target. And he's like, I don't know. But someday I'm going to be married, and someday I'm going to I'm going to need to recognize her and know that she has felt God's love. And I'm like, dude, I can do that. So we're praying for his wife. And then we go to Calvin's room. We're like, all right, Calvin, we're going to pray for your wife. And Calvin's like, yes, she has to like the X-Men. She has to be really good at climbing trees, you know. She's got to let me live by my mommy. I'm like, yes, she does. And then we go into Maya's room. You know, God saw fit to allow me to give birth to a woman on the freest country. And happy 4th of July. And I will tell you, for the veterans in the room, I owe you this day. My daughter, I said to her, I said, okay, Maya, we're going to pray for your husband. And she's like, okay. And so, you know, we're doing the rounds, and she's like, she prays that he is funny, and she prays that he is a good worker. And then she said, I pray like that he's like my daddy. And I promise you that you people have made him a man worthy of that little girl's prayer. And I, his devoted wife, I never know how to thank you for that. I promise you that this is not what was supposed to happen to me. I am so blessed to get to take my mom to powwows, and I send her sweetgrass, and I send her tribal drums, and I do everything. I bring her beadwork every time I come home because it heals that woman's heart. And I promise you also that if you do what I've done in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you too will get to be free from yourself and from your minds, and most importantly, from the obsession to drink. I haven't had a drink in a very long time, man, and that freaks me out. But more importantly, we get to be here together in this day, and I cannot thank you enough for standing in line and for being here, because you, I promise you, this is a dream I never knew I had. I never knew that I wanted to do this. I woke up this morning, I said, I've been waiting my whole life to do this, and I didn't even know it. So I hope that magic for you, and I love you, and I thank you.
Our next speaker is White Eagle M from Alberta, Canada.
My name is Rick McKay, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm going to really pretend I know what I'm saying here. And if I put this drink down, I don't want you to touch it, okay? I hear you used to drink a little bit. My sobriety date is March 20th, 1981. Yay. And I'm originally from Manitoba, but I'm here and very proud to be with my friends from Edmonton. I belong to the Big Book group. They have a longer version, so you know my memory's not that good. So I just / Big Book group. They meet on Monday nights and Thursday nights, and I have to tell you, if you want to be punished with love, do not go to that group. There's some guys here I just want to say hello to, and Ernie from Winnipeg. Nice you can make it, Ernie. The big Jose and his family from Mexico. The firemen from the Lower Mainland. Mr. Jambé, the world, very modestly wouldn't put his credentials yesterday, so I'll say it for you. An international artist from Alberta. And, you know, just to show you, don't be surprised, but I'm a native. And along the way, I've been privileged to be, found myself in the presence of people that knew something about what it is to be an Aboriginal person from Canada. And they advised me that, quite possibly, that I have a problem with delusion. And they asked me, they said, Rick, why is it that you go by your Christian name? And I said, well, that's the only name I was given. And they pointed out to me that, as far as we're concerned, we're looking at a native person here. I said, no shit. I said, that's news to me. But I'm not here because I'm native. I'm not at the podium because I'm native. I'm at the podium because I'm an alcoholic. Unless I forget that. Unless I forget that. You see, alcoholism has no respect for race, color, or creed. Correct? Though I hear, Larry says not to preach to the choir, but can I hear the choir? Say that again. And, you know, I wanted to come here and be the guy that will represent the Lone Ranger. Now, just a minute here now. I'll get to being a native soon. But when I grew up, as a previous speaker, a little intense, this girl, I think. I know, she was spitting those girls out pretty good there, I thought, for a while. And incidentally, I just wanted to say that welcome to the front row here. And welcome to the women in the meeting. I have, last count, I have six daughters. And needless to say, someone asked me, what clan do you come from? I said, the rabbit clan. We wanted to be just like Uncle Jack. Uncle Peter. I have eight brothers and four sisters. My uncle had eight daughters and one son. They grew in packs, you see. 12 packs. So I was destined to be here almost from the beginning. You know, and thank you all for coming, because you are as equal here as you are out there. And let me tell you how much I love you. See, the only divider I got is between my ears. Correct? I might break out into a different kind of talk if you keep that up. I'm also a son, a brother, an alcoholic, and more importantly, I'm one of God's kids. Unless I forget that. Unless you forget that. Unless you know that. That being the only problem that I got. Really, if you read the big book, you know that one there that, where was it? Oh, there it is. Just kidding. This book here, I was not a big fan of. Because when you're playing God, why would you be interested in somebody else's way? So I'm going to tell you that I have had a few problems. But as big as alcoholism was a problem to me, I had a bigger obstacle. And they call it self-centeredness. That being the root of the problem. The root. If alcoholism is a symptom, why am I just going to meetings just to stay sober? If that is not my primary problem. And yet, everywhere I go, you know, I've been fortunate to be here for a while. And I'll try to remember to keep my preaching down to a minimum. But you know, one of the things that comes with time, that I'm not a kid anymore. You see? I'm not a kid anymore. I'm a man. And I get to stand up in meetings. You can ask those guys in my group. And even that oddball there from Winnipeg there, Phil. That I get up in a meeting and I tell these young guys that if God's your problem, alcohol will have to be your answer. Because you cannot stay here and stay as you are. It's a divine impossibility to me, that being so. Because the answer is that why do we go to AA for then, if alcohol is our problem, primary problem? But as my friend Larry says, I'm not here because I drank too much juice. And yet, alcohol for a period of time was an answer to me. At the ripe old age of 10 years old, I was drinking from my father's lap. But as much as I can say that, I'm not going to say that I'm an alcoholic because my father gave me my first drink or anything else. So I'm just going to tell you that to save me a little bit of time because I want to get to the good stuff. I want to talk about a power greater than myself and how I came to believe. So I'll just sort of say, sort of clap it and say that, you know, that I'm an alcoholic. There doesn't need to be a reason why, except the fact that I'm powerless over alcohol. You know, one of the things that I find that there's those of us who sit in meetings and refrain from making a decision to turn their lives and will it over their lives to the care of God as they understand Him. And there's more debating going on in Alcoholics Anonymous than there is action. I was in a meeting the other day and I've seen three grown men cry in the meeting. Usually, once in a while, you might hear one. But there was three in the meeting. One of them forgot who he was. You see, when you forget who you are, you have to find an answer. Especially when you're in charge of your own life. So when I came to AA at the ripe old age of 21, you know, I had a lot of problems. Problems that persisted into sobriety. I was crazier than a loon. And I thought I was sober because I was attending meetings. I was going to 999 meetings a month. And so I'm going to sort of make a few statements. My friend asked if there was any newcomers here. There was a few hands that went up. But I'm going to ask, is there anybody hurting in the meeting? That's what makes you a newcomer. Not the length of where you are. Sorry. That's where you meet as a newcomer. So if you're sitting here with 5, 10, 15 years and you're hurting and you're lost and you're confused, you're at the same place of where a newcomer is in 2 or 3 days. That's where I was. That's why I know that. And that's why I say what I say. If talking was all there was to it, many of us would be in heaven already, would we not? Sounds overly simple, some of the stuff I'm saying. But I don't think God's got a computer up there. Or does He? Or am I missing something? Because I don't think so. Not the God that I understand. You see, the only thing that He knows is that you got a heart. I'm more interested in finding out people that got a heart. I had a kid working with me one day. And I asked him, what nationality are you? Oh, he said, I'm a white guy. And being very observant, I said, no, really. I said, what color is your blood? Well, I said, it's the same as yours. Well, I said, you know, at the end of the day, talk is cheap in this society. Talk is cheap. You know, when I was the profundity of the 12 steps to me was that all I had to be was in this guy's vicinity or people like him. And the obsession for alcohol left. It's not the same for everybody. I know we're supposed to take the steps and that happened. But in my case, the truth of my admitting when I was a 21-year-old was enough for me to get in the door. But this thing, coming to believe in a power greater than myself, was the elusive elixir that I was missing when I began my walk and thereafter. And why I was stumbling all over the place in Alcoholics Anonymous like a drunk man, sober. Sober. And every once in a while, you know, to keep up my rabbit heritage, I'd have a child somewhere. And, you know, and I was so unfit, they would have, I was negligent as a father. And I can remember, and please bear with me if I slobber through one of these kind of statements, but I have a daughter who's got cancer back home. And one of her sisters, who graduated with, that's her third degree, she's 27 years old, 28 years old. And I remind her that that's from her dad, she gets all that proudness. And she was supposed to be here. And she said, my goodness, I'm there in 5 minutes, I'll better scratch that story. She said, Dad, I can't go, but I have to look after my sister. When that little girl was the educated one, was 6 years old, I had to leave that family. And she came running downstairs and she said, Daddy, where are you going in the middle of the night? She said, my girl, I got to go, because my home was rampant with untreated alcoholism. Rampant. I didn't know what the term was at the time. And she said, how will you know where I am? And thinking that I was, I had to get this inspiration. And I said, my girl, when you think of Daddy, where is it that you feel him? And she pointed to her heart. And I said, that's where I'll be when you need me. And, but that repeated itself numerous times. My brothers and I, to make restitution for my mother, we formed a softball team. We traveled North America. I have two sons. I have a son playing hockey in California somewhere. I have a son who is a musician. And I have a couple of girls that I have a daughter who's an artist, Mr. Alec. And I taught some of these kids how to pray. After a while, they said, Dad, do we have to pray anymore? Because, you see, the thing is that the magic is that he just touched my leg, but don't get carried away when it's time for me to go. I I just want to say, as I wind this up, that needless to say, I'm pretty serious about this stuff, you know, because when you watch people die and you watch them struggle, they have a lot of trouble with this spiritual thing, but I just want to just sort of close with this. When I was a kid, my father had horses, and we used to lead these horses out. With deep curiosity, when this one particular horse came back, he had braids in his hair. And I couldn't figure out for the life of me when I was a kid, why would that horse have braids? I mean, it was out in the wilderness, comes back, and somebody sat there in the wilderness and braided his hair. And I watched the farmers. I watched the farmers that grow their wheat stuff. They don't debate about what's going in the ground. They just plant and they prepare. You see? And as I got older in AA, is that it's the action that you take that brings about the relationship with the power, and nothing else will. So I spend my time trying to help the young people. I'm 56, a young 56 as it is. Single, for those. As Mrs. V would say, leave my mother out of it. But I love you people. Absolutely. It doesn't matter what shape you come in, what color you are, because I believe that for me, am I done? You got a half hour yet? You see, it's what I think that holds us egocentric in place. And it's the lack of inventory. It's the lack of taking these defects of character and doing something with them. The good book says if you knock, you get an answer. And you know, to reclaim one's identity. You know, Canada, they're killing our women. 1,800 plus. I'm getting there. And you know, I have six daughters. And I honor the women. There was a guy in a meeting the other day that was calling his wife the bee. And I have a little trouble controlling my temper when I hear that kind of stuff. Because you're not that to me. And so I want to close by saying that I just want to read something just quickly. In case I never got around to saying it, this is what I was trying to say. I have it. I have these two daughters' picture right on this. I just wanted to say this. If I missed it, if you missed it. It says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. You will surely meet some of us as we trudge the road to happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you. Miigwech.
Next, we have Hawk R. from Gloversville, New York.
I'm Hawk, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is November 30th, 1965. I should say our sobriety date, because I didn't, nor could I do it alone. I was sitting up here listening, and I finally figured out why we have global warming. You know? counting the children here, and I had seven, so, you know. The overpopulation, you know. I'd like to thank you all for being here, because it's everybody that took up a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous that is the reason that I stand before you. You know, I got the letter, and it asked about speaking on the panel for Native. Can you hear me now? Okay. For on Native Americans in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hadn't thought about it much, but, you know, it's a big part of my story. I was raised on the Cheyenne River Reservation out in South Dakota. My father was full-blooded Lakota. My mother was half Nez Perce and half a whole mixture of Caucasian there. And life was good. I didn't have the problems on the res, but I remember, I think I was 4 years old, and I'm not going to be politically correct, by the way, because it's just certain things, and it's just the way that it was, and it's how it affected me. And we went into Rapid City, and we were there, and all of a sudden there were some people pointing at us, and I heard Dirty Rotten Indian, and then somebody else was pointing at us, and I heard Prairie Nigger, and I didn't know what that meant. And when we got back, I asked my grandfather, and he said, "Oh, that's a hateful word that's used by ignorant people." But when I look back, that was the first thing that really started to affect my life. That was the first ism. Because I decided from that point that I had to show everyone that I wasn't that dirty, rotten Indian. Not just that I was as good as you, but that I was better. And also in there somewhere, there was just a lot of rage. You know, at 6 years old, what happened was my father had been over in Europe fighting World War II. I was raised primarily by my grandparents and my uncles. And he didn't come back. He didn't get killed. He just didn't come back. And my mother figured he was out there sowing his wild oats. And so she wanted nothing more to do with Indians. So she picked me up at 6 years old and took me to Connecticut. Yeah. Wow. And they took me down to kindergarten, and I spoke very, very little English, and I had braids. And we all know what happened. You know, kids can be very, very cruel. And I ran home crying, and I cut my braids. And I looked in the mirror, and I said, "They'll never make me cry again." And that just kind of added up to all of that. So I spent most of my youth, I had all these different fears. I was afraid of people. If you knew who I was, you wouldn't like me. I was a dirty, rotten little Indian. I wasn't as good as. I didn't fit. I didn't fit anywhere. And so my answer to things was my fists. That was my rage, you know. It just, I could beat you into submission and you'd leave me alone. Or you would know that I beat somebody into submission and you would leave me alone. And oddly, with my story and when it comes to the alcohol, it's almost as if it made me mellow, because I had very, very little of that happened, I think. I don't know, because I was a blackout drinker. And people used to tell me, "Do you know what you did?" "No, what did I do?" And then after a while, it's, "No, and I don't want to know." But no real jackpots. And then I was, I don't know, I was 11 years old. And I was down at counseling, and they asked me to wait outside where they talked to my mother, and this kid came down. He was 8 or 9 years old, and for no reason, I jumped him, and I beat him, and I left him for dead. And a couple of weeks later, they figured out who it was, and again, I got lucky, because I just ended up with more counseling, so a lot of the stuff never ended up on my record. I think I was about 10, maybe 13, when I really had that first drink, you know. I mean, we're at a dance. And they had girls. And, you know, I knew if I asked any of them, they'd say no. and I wasn't really sure if I wanted to dance with girls anyway. But, you know, somebody had a little bottle of Old Factory Whistle, you know, a couple of shots of that, and you were off on a toot. And we shared it, and lo, I could dance, and I could puke. That's what I did. I asked the girl to dance, and she said, yeah, and I danced with her, went over, sat down, I puked all over. And then I don't remember anything that happened after that. But the rage was always there, you know. Hindsight's 20/20, and I was lost. I had been taken away from a world that I was used to, a world that was gentle, a world that was patient. And here I was thrust into this where everything was all of a sudden, even back then, in a hurry and everything else. And I lost my way spiritually, you know. And again, the fist got me in trouble. I was 17 years old, and something happened. I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was about, but it came out of a blackout. And this was a rage blackout. It had nothing to do with the drinking. And I was up on top of some guy and just banging his head down into the concrete. Enough to mush his skull up. So I ended up going to court, and they were trying to decide, first of all, if they were going to try me as a youngster or as an adult. And the state's attorney happened to be a friend of the family's, and he said, you know, he's a good boy. He just needs some straightening out, so maybe if he joins the service. And judge said, well, son, what would you like to do? Would you like to join the service, or would you like to go to jail? And I was a little shy on my 18th birthday. That was in December. My birthday was January 15th, you know, Martin Luther King Day. And it wasn't then when I was born. But so, you know, I thought about that for probably about 10 seconds, and I said, I'll go in the service. So they told me I had until my birthday. So, again, I got out there, and I said, okay, you know, here I am now. So what am I going to do? I got to be this tough guy, so I'm going to join the Marines. And a friend of mine said, oh, no, they're not the tough guys. I said, you got to look at these frogmen. And so I did, and they were the tough guys. And I went out, I joined the Navy, I went to Great Lakes, and then I became a frogman. And then later on, through an act of John F. Kennedy, they created a special warfare unit under the auspices of the United States Navy, and they created this special force for Vietnam that was called the SEALs. So I was a second class out of Coronado, and I was off to Vietnam. And again, the only real thing, I mean, you know, you drink when you're in the service, you drink and you do all this stuff and all this crazy stuff, and it's kind of accepted. And nothing really bad happened, except I got thrown out of jail in San Diego, California. Might have been some thought, you know, there that maybe something was a little funny, because that doesn't happen. I don't mean I went to court and got thrown out. I mean the police threw me out and told me not to come back. And so I was off to Vietnam, well, Southeast Asia, parts of that. I was one of them advisors, you know, non-combatants. And then later on, things intensified. And what actually got me to Alcoholics Anonymous was I came out of a blackout. We were on a mission. My job was to cover our withdrawal, and I had absolutely no idea what was going on. And again, nothing bad happened. But I made a decision at that point that I wasn't going to drink again, and up until this time, because this dirty, rotten little Indian always accomplished what he was going to do, you know. And 2 days later, I was sitting on that carry. I was on an 8-man carrier team that they used to run us into. Well, actually, we were at places that we weren't at, if you know what I mean. But I was sitting there with an 8-ounce tumbler of 190-proof grain alcohol that they use for cleaning the parts there. And I was devastated. That was my moment of desperation. Because now I knew two things. Number one, I knew that alcohol had control, and I knew that I couldn't stop on my own. And My mother was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she'd taken me to a couple of meetings 2 or 3 years early, you know, kind of check out and see what I'm doing. And, you know, it was a 12-step call, but I didn't know that. And I went to the meeting, and, you know, there were two old guys up there talking at the podium, Nebuchadnezzar and Methuselah. And I said, Jesus Christ, you know, if I got that old, and if I was that bad, I'd quit too, you know. Good for them. But, you know, my mother was still sober, and another couple that I knew, Ed and Lucille, had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, so they knew that it worked. And I said, that's it, when I get back, you know, when I get back to shore, I'm going to go to an AA meeting. So it was about 4 weeks later, and we made port in Groton, Connecticut, because they like to work us up there. They have the tanks that they use for the submariners, and they would work us in there with some stuff. And I went to my first meeting, and it was a speaker meeting, Mystic Monday night. And see, I knew when I got there, they were just going to hover. And I didn't want anybody to hover. So I had my dress blues. And for anybody that doesn't know, the Trident or the Budweiser, that's the largest insignia in the Navy. So it was, I'm going to show up at this meeting. I'm a SEAL. I kill people. Stay away. So I got to the meeting. I walked in. Guy making coffee. He says, "You new?" I said, "Yeah, I'm in the Navy." He said, "Well, I figured that from the uniform." And I said, "Yeah, I'm a SEAL." He said, "Well, that's nice, son." He says, "Why don't you just take the cotton out of your ears, put it in your mouth, and sit up front there and don't look at the broads." And there was a chief at that meeting, chief petty officer at that meeting that night, and suggested that, you know, I wear civvies from now on. You have to understand, before Betty Ford, alcoholism was a completely different thing, and especially in the service. But they came up to me after that, and they looked at me, and they said, "Well, Methuselah came up, because he told me I had a sponsor, and him was it." And then they said, "We're going to make you the chairman of this group." And I said, "Wow, they recognize talent, you know, when they see it." So they gave me a key. They told me to get there 2 hours early next week and put on 200-cup pots of coffee and set up the chairs, 150 chairs. And they suggested that I start the coffee before I start putting the chairs up so that the coffee would be done in time. And that became my home group. It was a speaker group, so we went out twice a week. We would go off to these different places, and I'd be in the back seat. I'd have, you know, a guy on this side of me, been sober since Moby Dick was a guppy. I had a guy over here that was Captain Ahab's great-grandfather. And that was the message that I got. And it's funny, it wasn't. See, they told me, "Don't worry about the steps, kid, because the steps are simple. We're going to give you a 4-step program." And it used to piss me off because they kept calling me kid. I killed people for a living. They're calling me kid. And I should say, at that first meeting, I was 23 years old. The next youngest person was 61. Yeah, geezers, you know. What the hell have I got myself into? But, you know, what I remember, I got down there, and the first thing I said was, because, you know, I hadn't been doing anything. I tried a bunch of different religions and the whole thing when I was younger, and it was just, it wasn't for me or anything else. And, of course, I wasn't around the Native community. And I told my sponsor, I said, "Well, I'm confused about this God thing." He said, "Well, don't be, because all you need to know is you ain't him." And then he said, "Have you ever seen one of those pictures from outer space?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Did you notice it doesn't revolve around you?" So that's kind of the way it was. And that 4-step program was, you know, hang on, let go, wants and needs. If it's a want, if it's a want, let go. If it's a need, hang on. And you don't really know the difference. That's what you got us for. So basically what happened, we did 6 months and then 6 months. I did a total of 8 combat tours. So now I'm going to be over in the jungle for 6 months, and they hooked me up with a pen pal. It was called Lonus International. And I had a lighthouse keeper out in New Zealand. Okay? And his name was Ian Fleming, no relation. But that was my contact. That was my contact with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I'm thinking now when we talk about the internet and the social media and just how much different all that would be. So, you know, my drinking, I had never really, as far as I've had, thought was the problem. But I got here and I said, if I just don't drink and I come here, because that's what they told me, you know. You go 24 hours, that's all you got to do. You don't have to stop the rest of your life. Don't drink, come to meetings and blah, 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 blah. And that's what I did for a long, long time. But some things happened. So now I've got 6 children and a wife. And 2 days back from leave, on leave, I pulled up to the house, and it was on fire. And I went in, and I got 2 out, and then I got 1 out, and then I went to go back in, and they grabbed me, the police and the firemen, and grabbed me, and they wouldn't let me go. If I had, I would have died. And I was standing there cursing God, and what had happened was the thing had gone off over the scanner, and people from Alcoholics Anonymous had heard about it. And there was a woman there from Alcoholics Anonymous, and she came up there, and she grabbed me, and she hugged me, and she didn't tell me it was going to be okay. What she said was, we'll get through this. And I didn't have to drink. And I'm just going to cut a couple of things. I ended up at 30 years sober doing a walkabout. I hiked from Whitewood, South Dakota, to Kings Canyon Sequoia National Park. It was a 2,700-mile fourth step because I still had the big black hole, and I had been sober for a long time. And like he said, if you're not following this program, you did that. And what I realized there was that everything they had told me at all these meetings was true, that it applied to all of us. And the person that went in there was a completely different person that came out of there. I had gone back to the reservation. I had hooked up with a bunch of the elders and everything else. And what happened was I got back involved in the Native community, and that helped. But I really want to talk about the healing power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to close with this last story. I got a call one day that my 17-year-old daughter had been run down and killed by a drunk driver. They lived a few towns away from us, and then someone called me and said he's going to AA. And he'd never gotten in trouble before, and this was it. Do you want to come down? And I said no. But I happened to be working at Rockville Hospital and dealing with Al-Anon people and telling them, you know, you blame the disease and not the alcoholic, so I thought maybe I better go down there. And when I did, I called Lil up and I told her I was coming down. As I got to that room and started down, I saw her across there with a guy, and as he came across the floor, I looked into his eyes. And if it was possible for anybody to feel more pain than me, it was him. And I ended up, and I embraced that man. His name is Tom. I ended up going to court for him. And as a result of that, he got no time. And I spoke at his first anniversary. The man is still sober today. That was God working in my life and taking away that anger. And I haven't felt rage since then. You know, I just like to say, I keep saying I stand here, and I keep saying it can't get better. But it does. And I think part of that is, I'm not going to do it, but I've been involved in service in Alcoholics Anonymous at the District of the Area level for 35 years. Because for what I've been given today, what's that worth? You know, what's that worth? Because this is what we do. I'd like to thank you all for being here and helping me to stay sober today. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lester, and I'm an alcoholic.
in the email I was given, I was told that there was a little bit of time left I'd be able to share. So I'm going to share just a little bit about where I come from. Thank you, guys. You know, what I heard today was family. I grew up on a reservation. I didn't have a real relationship with my dad. My dad died when I was 12. Baby at a family, I have an older brother. The only thing I knew was mom. It's the only thing I knew was mom, because mom provided for me. You know, my story is just like anybody else's. You know, I'm not a son. You know, I don't know how to be a son. I don't know how to treat people. But man, you give me a drink, and man, that sense of ease and comfort that comes with that first drink. You know, my last debacle with alcohol. I received a call on May 12th at 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, they asked for me by name, and they said, "We're sorry. You know, we tried working on her for 20 minutes, and we couldn't revive her." And that was the day I lost my best friend. That was my mom. That's when I turned my back on God, and alcohol became the only thing I knew to know how to live. You know, when I became that person, my story isn't any different. I ended up in jail. I ended up in institutions. I ended up on the street. You know, I ended up absolutely hopeless. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted to die. Every time I got drunk, I asked God, "Please don't let me wake up this time." 3 suicide attempts, and I'm still here. I remember sitting down with my sponsor, and he asked me, he said, "Do you believe your higher power has a plan for you after all you've been through?" And I couldn't argue with him. In my early sobriety, there was a time where the drink was going to solve everything for me, and he gave me a choice. He said, "You know, Lester, you're right here." He goes, "If you want to drink that bad," he said, "get in the car and I'll take you to the bar and I'll buy you your first one. But you're here at a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you walk inside and shake some hands and get out of yourself?" Thank God I took that suggestion, you know, to walk inside and to get out of myself and shake some hands and ask them how they're doing. If you would have told me I have the life I have today 8 years ago, I would have told you no way. Because I am not worthy of it. I am not worthy of it. I've gotten way more than I deserved. If I've gotten what I deserved, I would not be here. You guys gave me a gift, and that gift is to be able to handle life on life's terms. I have a solution today, and I know that no matter whatever happens, I don't have to drink. That brother I was talking about, that I mentioned, died of this disease 3 years ago. I got to be a brother to him. I got to make amends to him. I got to show up. And he instilled in me that responsibility, that R word. I showed up, and the doctor, when he left the hospital, said, "When you get him home, you'll have about 2 weeks with him." I left for home on a Wednesday. We sat in his room. He said, "I want you to come in with me." He goes, "I want you to pick out my casket. I want you to pick out my clothes, and I want you to dress me." That was a Wednesday and a Thursday, and he died on a Friday. He died in my arms in his home. He looked at me and said, "Little brother, I'm going home today." And you know, I didn't have to drink. But I got to pick up the phone and call my sponsor. And he said, "Lester, looks like you get to be of service to his family now, isn't it?" Through these steps, I remember a sponsor telling me, he said, "You know, Lester, steps 1, 2, and 3 get you in touch with the higher power. Steps 4 through 9 teach you how to live and get right." He said, "Long ago," he said, "Bill W. was asked to sum up the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in 2 words. He said, in 10, 11, and 12, God willing, you get to live a life of love and service. You know, not every day is perfect, and I am not perfect, but it's a lot better than what it used to be." I remember my very first international 5 years ago in San Antonio, the old-timer that took me. he said, you know, just get in the car and come along. You got a front row seat to see what your Creator made. And he was right. And he was right. And you know, I was able, this time around, I was able to pay it forward. And I was able to bring along a guy that I sponsor who was 5 months sober. You know, he got to get in the car and come along. And you know, the life I have today, I would have never dreamed it. You know, it's by taking some simple suggestions of getting a home group, finding a sponsor, working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and doing some service work. God has a funny sense of humor because I was not supposed to chair this meeting. You know, I was supposed to chair the 9 o'clock meeting this morning. And my friend Todd called me and said, Lester, are you going to the International because I need your help? He goes, there's a service commitment that I have and I'm not going to be able to make it. And I said, sure, Todd. He said, Lester, I'll call you back in 5 minutes. He calls me back and he says, yep, Lester, he said, God sure does have a sense of humor. He goes, Eva Sanchez had asked if I knew a Native American that was going to the International Conference because she needs a chair for the AA Native People's Meetings. He said, I got to get off the phone with you now, Lester. She'll be in touch because I still got to find a replacement for myself. It's amazing what it takes just to what happens when you just show up. When you just show up. You know, so today you guys are my family. You guys are my examples of what to do and what not to do. You guys have taught me how to live. There's an old timer in Rapid City in her meetings. And I know she got this from someone else, and I am going to repeat it, but she always closes her talks with this. She goes, thank you, not for what you have done for me, but for what you have instilled in me to allow me to do that, which I cannot do myself. My name is Lester, and I'm an alcoholic. Once again, I'd like to thank our speakers, Jeanette, White Eagle, and Hawk.